2009 has been a year of transition for Afghanistan. Violence has exponentially increased, and hard-won gains made in the beginning of the war effort have deteriorated. In the months since his inauguration, President Obama has ordered the deployment of over 21,000 additional combat troops to Afghanistan, an increase parallel in size to the 2007 surge in Iraq. The U.S. military is currently completing a strategic review of all operations in Afghanistan, and an election in August promises to shake up the country's political landscape. Joining me to discuss what Afghanistan's fraught past might mean for its future is Seth Jones, an adjunct professor at Georgetown and the U.S. Naval Graduate School, an analyst for the RAND Corporation, and the author of In the Graveyard of Empires, which is published by W.W. Norton. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, Leonard. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you've visited Afghanistan over a dozen times, I gather, since 9/11, and yet it's my sense that you didn't intend this book to be a piece of firsthand reporting.
No, I wanted to actually tell the story about what happened since the 9/11 attacks in Afghanistan, but it wasn't my story. It was the story about what happened to U.S. forces, diplomats, intelligence officers, and Afghans during that time period.
Are you about to go back?
Well, I just got back Monday, so I'm here for about two more weeks.
Where do you go? Because most Westerners, as I understand, base themselves in Kabul, visit Kandahar perhaps, but travel little elsewhere because it's so difficult and perhaps even dangerous?
Well, it's excruciatingly difficult in parts of the South and the East. I've traveled all over the country in more benign parts of the country. I can travel with friends. I can travel with NGOs. But in the more violent parts of the country, it generally requires traveling with a coalition, NATO or other coalition forces, and often requires Black Hawk helicopters because land travel can be extremely dangerous.
Because people will stop you on the road?
Well, what the Taliban has done in places like Highway 1, the main road from Kabul to Kandahar, is they will stop buses. If you were to travel by bus or car, they'll board and they'll ask for everything in your pockets. And cell phones that have any connection to an international phone, passport, foreign passport, they'll take you.
That doesn't sound like the sort of thing that wins hearts and minds.
Well, on the Taliban side, they're doing this to foreigners and infidels, so I think the impact on local Afghans is probably minimal.
In the book, you document the experiences of the past empires that have tried to who've invaded Afghanistan only to meet with eventual defeat. Were U.S. policymakers conscious of those historical examples as they formulated their invasion policy?
Well, when you actually look at the writings and the comments of senior U.S. policymakers in 2001 and 2002, I do think they were acutely conscious of the Soviet lessons and the British lessons and Alexander the Great's lessons.
Well, you quote General Tommy Franks, the head of the U.S. Central Command, as saying, "Secretary Rumsfeld and I agreed that we should not flood the country with large formulations of conventional troops. We don't want to repeat the Soviets' mistakes." So that's how we wound up with this this light footprint strategy. But did the inferences that Rumsfeld and his advisors like Paul Wolfowitz had on the Soviet experience have any validity? Because as it turns out, wasn't that strategic decision to only initially deploy 8,000 American troops something of a mistake?
Well, I think the problem was, in hindsight, which is always easier, the biggest lesson that I took from the Soviet experience was not the number of forces they had in Afghanistan. It was what they were doing with them. They were using forces to fight conventionally in Afghanistan. They were using helicopters, Hind gunships to eliminate entire villages. They were moving in with tanks. They were fighting a guerrilla war using conventional tactics. So I actually think that's the biggest lesson, not the number of troops at all. In fact, quite the opposite. The early indications were that Afghans wanted large numbers.
It's amazing that those mistakes are made again and again, because the American Revolution was lost by the British to some degree because they were fighting a conventional war against guerrillas. In Vietnam, we had real problems because we were doing the same sort of thing. And I probably can cite 10 or 15 other wars where major powers have made the same kinds of mistakes. The British did it all over the world, didn't they, at one point or another?
Sure, and the Pakistanis are doing it in Pakistan right now against the Taliban groups that are allied with what the U.S. is fighting in Afghanistan.
So who advocated for this approach, and were there people who were advising against it?
Well, I would say the biggest breakdown ended up coming between elements of the Pentagon, which argued for a very light footprint, and elements of both the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. State Department, which were arguing for a much larger peacekeeping footprint in Afghanistan, because the problem at the time was that there were too few Afghan national forces, and without a lot of coalition forces, there was going to be a vacuum in the country, which turned out to be the case.
Well, we had the Powell Doctrine in effect, didn't we? Why was that totally ignored?
I think in general there was an unwillingness within the Department of Defense to do what was called nation building. And the Secretary of Defense at the time and much of his senior staff, including the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Doug Feith, were quite open that they were not going to do nation building. They were going to pull U.S. forces out of Kosovo and ideally Bosnia as well. So I think this was a broader issue within the Pentagon.
So if we weren't going to do nation building, what did we expect to happen? After all, this is a country that had been in chaos before the Taliban came to power.
Well, I think the primary focus was on counterterrorism. It was focusing on capturing or killing al-Qaeda individuals, and the rest of this should be left up to the Afghans. So that was the basic logic of the argument.
And even if that meant a chaotic situation politically, that was okay? Or a bunch of warlords going at each other as they had in the past, that was okay?
I think it was okay as long as the United States homeland was not directly threatened.
You're right that the war in Afghanistan was waged with the lowest levels of troops, police, and financial assistance in any stabilization operation since the end of World War II. This was a drastic departure from conventional wisdom about modern invasions and occupations.
It was. And in fact, when I talked to, for example, Secretary Powell not that long ago about his view of the situation, he was very strongly in favor, he said at the time, of doing what the U.S. did in Panama, which was a fairly large number of forces to flood the area until the situation was stable, and then U.S. forces could depart.
You quote a 19th century British commander, Frederick Roberts, who advised, "The less the Afghans see of us, the less they will dislike us." Was that the guiding philosophy here?
Well, I think it was to some degree, although I would say that quote was probably not appropriate for the early periods. I think Afghans in general, and public opinion polls done by organizations like the Asia Foundation, pretty clear that Afghans wanted the U.S., wanted U.S. assistance in rebuilding their country and help in stabilizing Afghanistan after over 20 years of fighting. So I don't think that was the case at that time.
You know, one of the problems we've had in Iraq is the fallout from all of the revelations about Abu Ghraib. This morning, the New York Times reports on poor conditions and new evidence of prisoner abuse in the detention center in Bagram Air Base. Will that be a big story in the Afghan press as well?
It'll probably, and it already has gotten some attention, nowhere near the attention that Abu Ghraib got. I mean, the photographs depicting those quite serious issues were something that we haven't seen in Afghanistan. So I think absent that, this issue will pick up some steam. But for the most part, actually one of the more interesting elements of detention policies is the commander for the Taliban of the South right now is a recently former Guantanamo Bay a detainee named Mullah Zakir.
Are there photographs? Because the president has refused to release some this year. Are there any from Bagram?
I have never seen any or even seen indications of photographs from Bagram.
Seth G. Jones' book, In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. It's published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You quote Admiral Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as saying, "Our focus militarily in the region and in the world right now is rightly and firmly in Iraq. It is simply a matter of resources and capacity. In Afghanistan, we do what we can. In Iraq, we do what we must." Well, why did the invasion and occupation of Iraq take precedence over the war in Afghanistan? Because the 9/11 attacks were traced directly back to Afghanistan.
Well, it's hard to get into the psychological elements of what was motivating some people to focus predominantly on Iraq as opposed to Afghanistan. But I will say the intelligence that the U.S. had on senior al-Qaeda individuals clearly pointed to the predominance of them in either Afghanistan or in Pakistan by 2002 and 3 and 4, and that included not just bin Laden, but Ayman al-Zawahiri and a range of others.
So were we just willfully ignoring what our intelligence was telling us?
I think that's probably part of it, but I think in general there was some debate about the importance of Saddam Hussein and what he meant in the region. I mean, he clearly was a major power.
You report that the Office of Budget Management was particularly stingy in providing aid to Afghanistan.
Virtually everybody I spoke to, from ambassadors in particular, military commanders, said getting supplemental and other funding for Afghanistan was extremely arduous.
And you write that Ronald Newman, the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, requested an extra $600 million for troop funding and aid to Afghanistan in 2006, was given $43 million.
In fact, one of the things that Ambassador...
It's less than 10%.
Less than 10%. One of the things Ambassador Newman said to me is on his exit brief with President Bush after he left as ambassador, he suggested if he could put a JDAM, a GPS bomb anywhere, it would be on the Office of Management and Budget for for their problems in getting the requisite funding.
Britain in the past few days has been embroiled in a political controversy after it's been revealed that British troops in Afghanistan have been consistently underfunded and undersupplied, particularly in the form of air support. Why hasn't the funding situation in Afghanistan caused more of a public outcry in this country?
Well, I think finally we're beginning to see an increase in funding in Afghanistan. There are more troops that are going in. There are more intelligence operatives moving into the country. There's something of a civilian diplomatic surge in the country. It's interesting that when I was over at the U.S. Embassy the other day, they're having problems with bed space because they have more people than they do rooms to house them in. So I think what I would say now is there is finally what we're seeing over the past 6 to 8 months, an increase in resources towards Afghanistan. But I heard this repeatedly over the past decade, just not a lot of funding.
Rory Stewart, a recent guest on our show, somebody you know, is among a number of experts who disagree that more troops will, in fact, stabilize the country. What's happening there? He's arguing that troops might even make things worse in a country with long-term problems, which demand long-term structural solutions.
Well, I think the issue is not the number of troops, especially foreign troops. I think the predominant focus, and this has been true not just in Afghanistan but in other insurgencies, is what one does with the forces there. If American or other international forces are used to win a war in Afghanistan for the Afghans, that generally is not a winnable war. If they're used to work with and train Afghans to do it, that's a very different use of those forces. So I would say a lot depends on what one does with the forces one has.
So even if we hadn't had that light footprint, we still might have approached Afghanistan in a poor way because we didn't really understand what we needed to do?
Well, we certainly could have in retrospect. You know, the other problem that would have been a challenge too is Pakistan, because what we saw with every major senior Taliban and many senior al-Qaeda officials, they just moved across the border in Afghanistan. So even more resources and forces devoted to Afghanistan would not in and of itself have taken care of the Pakistan problem.
I've had somebody else you know on the show many times, Sarah Chase, and she really feels that this whole matter is a Pakistani problem for the United States because Pakistan has been so implicated in it, was a supporter of the Taliban for so long, and some people say still the ISI, the intelligence unit of Pakistani military, is supporting the Taliban at the same time that the Taliban is causing so much trouble within Pakistan.
Well, I mean, I think there is no question. There is some evidence that NATO forces have compiled that Pakistan has provided and is continuing to provide some assistance to Mullah Muhammad Omar's Taliban and the Haqqani network. But I would say also that a lot of the problems one finds in Afghanistan are also a function of what I would call a collapse of governance in Afghanistan. People do criticize the corruption in the country. the poor performance of the police. So I think to blame this entirely on Pakistan, or even mostly on Pakistan, is to fundamentally misunderstand the grievances among Afghans.
Well, how much of it is because of the warlords? After the Soviets left, the warlords just went after each other, and they engaged in constant battle. When the Taliban came in, as I understand it, they were kind of greeted with warmth because people felt they would stabilize the situation. Even Western governments and Western companies were happy to see them come in and end all of this internecine fighting.
Well, one of the first things the Taliban did in 1994 was take down checkpoints in and around Kandahar City on highways 4 and 1 that were run by either warlords or criminal organizations. So that has certainly historically been a problem. They are a problem in some parts of the country today. And this is an area, I think, where the Taliban has some advantage over NATO and coalition forces. It has a legacy of pushing back against warlord commanders.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned earlier is that people could just go across the border into Pakistan anyway. We're talking about a very large border. Would it be possible, if we had sent in a lot of troops, could they have actually prevented the sort of porous situation that's there from happening?
No, the border is it's over 1,500 miles long. It's mountainous in many places. And there are a range of Pashtun tribes, sub-tribes, clans, and actually non-Pashtuns as well that live on both sides of the border, so have legal rights to move across the border. There is no way that U.S. or any other forces could have prevented people from moving around and across that border. Absolutely no way.
Still, there have been many claims that we probably could have captured Osama bin Laden if we had gone after him with U.S. troops instead of Afghan troops.
Well, that was, I think, certainly true in the vicinity of Tora Bora in December 2001. But I think what becomes clear in the Pakistani border areas, too, is this really needs to be a function of Pakistan's national security services assisting more pronounced than they have in capturing some of these Afghan insurgents.
What's the problem there? In Tora Bora, it seemed like whoever was paying a warlord, or in any number of situations in the early years, early months anyway, no matter who was paying the warlord the most money was the one who was going to get the most support.
I think that's generally correct, and we know that bin Laden was providing fairly serious amounts of money to a range of Pashtun tribes along the border. So it could very well have been, and it does appear from a range of CIA operatives on the ground at the time that it may have been a money issue.
And is that still the situation? There's still warlords all over Afghanistan, aren't there?
There are some warlords. There are plenty of areas, though, where the tribal structure is somewhat intact. A range of Pashtun sub-tribes, clans are still intact. So there are some warlords, but there are a range of areas where the tribal system is quite pronounced and quite powerful.
My guest is Seth G. Jones, who is a RAND political scientist and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. His latest book is In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. It is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Seth G. Jones. His latest book, In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan, published by Norton. Afghanistan called the Graveyard of Empires because everybody has tried, not everybody, but too many have tried to conquer it and nobody has succeeded, really.
Well, I think the only people that have succeeded in stabilizing Afghanistan are the Afghans. So, but no foreign army using its own forces has been successful, I think, over a prolonged period of time in stabilizing the country. I think that's the Graveyard of Empires indication.
When Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went there, she accused the Pakistani government of basically abdicating to the Taliban and to the extremists. Have you seen evidence of that?
Well, I think there are some areas in South and North Waziristan and parts of the tribal agencies where a range of different militant networks have and remain extremely strong. The Pakistani state is weak. But there clearly are areas like the Swat Valley where Pakistan's Frontier Corps Army and intelligence services have provided and conducted a range of sustained operations. So there's some areas where they actually have not abdicated.
So since we fund Pakistan's counterinsurgency efforts. Can we attach benchmarks or restrictions to our money and say, well, we're happy with what you're doing with SWAT, but we're really unhappy with what you're doing on the border or in some of these other areas, which seem to just have given over to the Taliban?
Well, I think we can. I'm not sure doing this publicly would be the best way of doing it, but I think the senior leadership of the Taliban, what's called its inner shura, is located in the Balochistan province of Pakistan. So why is it that they continue to operate in many cases openly in cities like Karachi and Quetta? Can the U.S. funding meet benchmarks like capturing or killing senior Taliban figures? I think that would be certainly appropriate.
Well, the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has suggested U.S. efforts to fight a war on terror should be focused on Pakistan rather than Afghanistan. Is he just saying something that's self-serving?
Well, I think that's partly self-serving. I know a number of senior Afghan government officials do tend to blame Pakistan for all the ills that Afghanistan faces. Probably easier to blame somebody else than to blame yourself. But I do think a lot of the problems when you get into rural areas of Afghanistan, villages that I have traveled to, there's a lot of unhappiness with the Afghan government. So this certainly is not a function of what happens in Pakistan entirely.
Can we assume that these upcoming elections, will be fair and square considering what's been happening throughout the region?
Well, that's unclear at the moment. One can certainly hope that they'll be fair. Actually, my bigger concern is that most Afghans will become apathetic now, that they believe their government is corrupt, so they will not turn out in the numbers that they turned out in 2004 and then even 2005. So my concern actually is an apathy. I've been into areas of Afghanistan where people have never heard of the current president, Hamid Karzai. People didn't know that we were U.S. forces. They thought we were Soviet forces in the country. So I do think the central government anyway has disappeared in huge parts of rural areas.
Well, who's running those areas?
Well, they tend to be local power brokers. They're either warlords or, in many cases, they're tribes, sub-tribes, or clans, but generally not the central government.
And Kabul has no connection to them? Or has no desire to have them tell the people what's going on?
Well, I think Kabul would like to have it, but what currently exists in Kabul does not have the power and the ability, whether it's the delivery of services or whether it's police, to put electricity in areas, put police in all areas of a province. The government is just too weak right now.
With all of this, it's probably easy to forget that Afghanistan enjoyed a period of relative prosperity and peace in the 1960s. Why did it work then?
Well, actually, it wasn't just the 1960s. It was, one could go from the 1930s all the way up to the early 1970s. I think it worked for probably two major reasons. One is the government at the time was actually quite legitimate, especially for that last decade. Zahir Shah was generally viewed as legitimate. He was the king. And second,
The U.S. State Department lauded the 1964 Constitution as a blueprint for democracy.
Sure. It was. He was not directly elected, but members of the upper house and lower house were elected. And there was a new constitution that he put in. So there were some elements of democracy that were established.
So what happened? Soviet meddling?
Soviet meddling in the late 1970s began to undermine that. And then when the Soviets finally invaded in December 1979, that really began the period of instability that Afghanistan still faces.
Well, they said that they were invited.
Well, they said they were invited. But what is interesting, and I went through a lot of the Soviet archives now from the KGB, the Army, and the Politburo, a lot of the Soviet military establishment did not want to go into Afghanistan because they understood very well the problems that they would face.
Well, as you said earlier, they went in and they were fighting a conventional war. But Alexander the Great, who conquered half of the known world at the time, couldn't win in Afghanistan, and he understood how to fight these kinds of wars.
Well, he understood how to fight, but he didn't remain in a lot of these places for very long. I mean, what's interesting about his march into Afghanistan, he comes in through the west in Herat, moves south into Kandahar, and then moves up into the Kabul River Valley. But then he moves on to India. So a part of the problem was the empire that he wanted to create was so large, and his forces were relatively small, that he just could not keep that many people in a single place.
So they were stretched thin, and then that made them vulnerable to attack.
And then he died. And then he died of disease in South Asia.
But what are there other factors? we're often told just how harsh the geography of Afghanistan can be.
When I fly over parts of the east and especially the south, what you're struck by is two things. One is just the general brown environment, not a lot of rainfall. In parts of the northeast, there is in Kunar and Nangarhar, but chunks of Afghanistan don't get a lot of rainfall. It's obviously landlocked. And second, I can't tell you how many villages that I've been in that I wonder if it was like this 1,000 years ago. Just not a lot of advanced technology. So the fact is you've got a very poor country with very low literacy rates and no natural resources.
My guest is Seth G. Jones. His book, In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan, published by Norton. So the Soviets come in there, and they are ultimately defeated by a group of different Mujahideen forces, not always in coalition with each other. But one thing they have in common, they hate the Soviets?
Well, they hate the Soviets, but they also have Pakistan's ISI was deeply involved in bringing the seven major groups together and trying to create a strategy with support, obviously, from the Saudi intelligence and from the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States.
And the United States gave them, supplied the Mujahideen quite heavily. What's happened since has been described to some degree as a blowback, including some of the U.S. weaponry winds up being used against us.
Yeah, I think most of that is slightly overstated. There actually are some Stinger missiles that have been that exist in Afghanistan. There was a buyback program from the CIA, but there have been, to my knowledge, no Stingers used. They've generally lost their shelf life. So I do think some of these arguments are a little overstated.
What about just teaching the troops, especially the Al Qaeda people, how to fight this kind of war?
Well, what's interesting is when you actually look at the Soviet role or the Al Qaeda role in Afghanistan in the 1980s, it was minimal. If it really seriously existed at all. And Larry writes, The Looming Tower, he says forthrightly in his research, he found no serious role played by Al Qaeda. In the major role by the head of ISI's Afghan bureau, he never mentions Al Qaeda or any of the other foreign fighters in the Soviet war. So I actually think, in general, they played a marginal role at best.
So how do Al-Qaeda and the Taliban wind up in this alliance, considering the fact that they have very different visions of Islam? I don't see much to tie them together other than they both seem to hate the West.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that tied them together. One was they are both Sunni Sunni Muslims. Second is there were some joint relationships established in the 1980s, one when bin Laden was in Pakistan, and especially in Peshawar. And then third, bin Laden's stand against the West, and especially the United States, did get him revered by a range of Taliban figures. So by the mid to late 1990s, when bin Laden was looking for a place to settle, he was welcomed with open arms by Mullah Omar.
What happened in other countries? Bin Laden was under a cloud in Saudi Arabia, although his family was prominent. Did the Saudis support the Taliban?
The Saudis did support the Taliban for a number of years anyway. U.S. pressure, especially after the attacks against the U.S. embassies in Africa, in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi, there's a very famous moment where the head of Saudi intelligence goes to Afghanistan in the late 1990s and asks Omar to give up bin Laden because his citizenship and his visa have been revoked from Saudi Arabia. And Omar says, absolutely not. And at that point, you saw a major break between Saudi Arabia and the Taliban.
Now, the Taliban are really just they're former students who wound up creating some kind of army. How effective were they as a governing organization?
Well, people that I know quite well that went into Afghan Taliban ministries in Kabul describe the structure as virtually non-existent. What they did is they cut a range of deals in rural Afghanistan with warlord commanders, but especially tribes and sub-tribes and clans. So what they were able to do was establish some sense of order in parts of the country and justice, but they didn't really have a functioning government per se, other than in areas like Kabul itself.
And how did the mullah Muhammad Omar come to lead the Taliban?
Well, very interesting story. One of the more significant events is in Kandahar City in 1996, where he puts on the cape of the Prophet Muhammad, wraps it around himself, and declares himself in front of a range of mullahs the commander of the faithful. So,
and they just accepted that.
And he was accepted. Now, Mullah Omar has been somebody who's actually generally quiet, is not self-serving, and certainly not viewed that way. So, but he was accepted and has played that role.
You're right that recruitment for the Taliban is governed by the laws of supply and demand. What do you mean by that?
Well, in general, that Taliban have gone into areas where there's a demand for governance and justice and security. There's a vacuum of governance in general, and they've supplied it. They've created created what are often called parallel or shadow government structures. So they've supplied justice and governance in an area where there is none.
Was there more governance a few years ago? In 2004, fewer than 300 Afghans died because of the insurgency, and that number has increased considerably in recent years.
Well, there was some hope at that point, I would say, and people were certainly hoped that things would change. So I think the patience levels were much different in those early periods. And by 2005 and 2006, it was clear in a lot of rural Afghanistan the situation was simply not changing.
As late as 2006, General James Jones, the NATO commander, said the Taliban and al-Qaeda are not in a position where they can restart an insurgency of any size and major scope. In 2007, Hamid Karzai reported to President Bush that the Taliban was a force that's defeated. And here we are.
Well, it's hard to know whether there's
wishful thinking.
It's hard to know whether those were just for public consumption. I suspect, based on intelligence reporting, they didn't believe entirely those assessments in private.
You write that Afghanistan in 2006 had a fin de siècle air. Why did our fortunes turn after so many marked improvements that were made in the previous years?
Well, the improvements tended to be largely in urban areas. Kabul itself was regenerated by an infusion of international assistance. But again, in rural parts of the country, people did not see a major change.
And the New York Times reports that 2009 is becoming one of the most deadly years in the Afghan occupation. More than 465 IEDs have killed 45 American soldiers. Is al-Qaeda responsible for these roadside bombs?
No, not really. Al-Qaeda's role is actually as a force multiplier. They do play a very small role in a lot of these IEDs. They have helped improve the technology of organizations like the Taliban and the Haqqani network. But I would say their role is relatively minimal, and they're largely based out of Pakistan.
Well, so much of what's going on in Afghanistan is not just the U.S.-led approach. We have all these other countries, England, Italy, Germany. Are they in agreement as to how to approach the situation?
No, there are very different views across NATO countries. The British forces operate in Helmand province. The Dutch are in Ruzgan. The Canadians in Kandahar.
Any doing better than others?
I would say probably not, especially in the areas that are most violent in the south. There is a general difficulty in what's called holding territory. A lot of these countries will clear areas but have a very difficult time holding it. So I think most countries face very similar problems in violent parts of the south.
You write that in your study of insurgencies that a successful counterinsurgency campaign lasts for typically 14 years. So we're talking about 2015.
Well, we're talking about just moving over the halfway point for this, which is why I think people who have and there was a Newsweek a cover article a couple of months ago about is Afghanistan Obama's Vietnam. It's probably a little too early to make those conclusions. We're really at the halfway point on average of an insurgency.
But more troops are arriving weekly to the region.
More troops are arriving, especially in the south of Afghanistan. It's the Marines in Helmand province and Farah and some of the southern provinces.
Do you see anything positive in all of this?
Well, probably the most interesting development, I think, that's been part of the 60-day assessment from General McChrystal is questions about are there ways to leverage local Afghans, that is, tribes, sub-tribes, and clans in the south and the east. There do appear to be a range of Barakzais and Noorzais that do not like the Taliban. As one commander, a local tribal leader in the south, said to me, that my problem with the Taliban is they try to tell me how to live my life. If I want to grow my beard short, I'll grow it short. If I want to grow it long, I'll grow it long. Nobody tells me how long to grow my beard.
And we've had some kind of success with a similar approach in Iraq.
Yeah, very different tribal system, but there was a bottom-up strategy that was implemented in Iraq. I mean, it would have to be very different from Iraq. I mean, the tribal structure is different in many fronts.
Seth Jones is a RAND political scientist and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. His book, In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
On tomorrow's show, the rise and fall of a China to New York human smuggling ring run by an unlikely crime boss, a middle-aged grandmother known as Sister Ping. Then we will look at the off-Broadway production of the new musical, The Tin Pan Alley Rag. Also, law scholar and best-selling author Stephen Carter on his latest thriller, Jericho's Fall. Plus, Barbara Ehrenreich and Molly Haskell look at how women in the workplace have been portrayed in movies on our latest projection series installment. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Alex Conrad, Natalie Pano, Nicole Silversack, and Adam Delahanty. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.